This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. What does it mean to be a worker today? For some, it means demanding better pay and more jobs. That's what tens of thousands of General Motors factory workers are doing on this, the first day of a national strike. For others, it means working one gig at a time, getting in your car, turning on an app, and hoping for the best. The ways that we work are evolving, and lawmakers are debating how to protect workers today. But just as the latest apps are coming largely from California, so too are the laws that might fundamentally change how companies based there treat workers. And you know what they say. As California goes, so goes the nation. What is the right way to help companies thrive and help their employees survive? Are people like Lyft drivers employees of Lyft? Or are they independent contractors for Lyft? And what might all this mean for you as a consumer? Joining us here in studio is Stephen Greenhouse, a former labor reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Steve, welcome to 1A.
Great to be here, Josh.
Joining us from Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey is Janice Fine, an associate professor and the director of strategy and research at the university's Center on Innovation and Worker Organization. Professor Fine, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
And we'd love to hear your questions and your thoughts about organized labor, particularly if you work in or have worked in the state of California. Perhaps you or someone you know is connected to this GM worker strike and you can just share what you know about what's going on today. Or maybe you are an employer who is looking at what's happening with labor laws and the changing nature of work and have questions or concerns or maybe hopes for the future. Email us, work1a at wamu.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Stephen Greenhouse, let me start with you. Can you just give us a little more detail about the GM worker strike? This isn't something that came out of nowhere.
No. So the strike began at 12:01 a.m. this morning. Around 49,000 workers walked out at 34 plants, 22 parts plants, 12 regular auto assembly plants in six states. And, you know, GM is an iconic company. It had $8.1 billion in profits last year. And the workers say the raises GM's offering are not high enough. But I think more than that, the union, the workers are really angry that GM has shut several plants, including the famous Lordstown, Ohio plant. And the workers are really upset also that GM has been moving more factories and jobs overseas. And American workers in the age of Trump say, you know, you should bring more of these jobs back home. And there's a real tug of war about trying to get the Lordstown plant open, some plants in Michigan open, and a plant in Baltimore open. GM says we can't do it. Demand for autos is down. They have to invest a lot of money in the new generation of electronic cars. And they say, we can't be as generous as you would like, folks in the union.
There have been a lot of strikes going on lately. As I understand it, last year marked the highest number of workers participating in strikes, over 1,000 people, since the 80s. How does this strike fit into the trends of what we've been seeing lately?
So in part, Josh, I was surprised by the strike. And I think one of the reasons it happened is that there have been other successful strikes, and successful strikes beget new strikes. And there were the, you know, famous teacher strikes last year in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona. They got front page news. They made people feel better about unions. There was a big strike against Marriott. There was the huge strike by 30,000 Shop and Stop workers in New England. And it's kind of contagious, infectious. And I think that GM workers think those strikes succeeded. This is a time of increased militancy for workers. The public approval rating for unions is nearly the highest it's been in 50 years. So they said, let's, you know, unemployment is low, GM's doing very profitably, it's time to walk out.
So, Stephen, it's not just a matter of what the workers think that they can get from the company, but also kind of what the workers think they can get from the public in terms of building support for their cause.
Yes. And so I read about the Stop and Shop strike in New England. You know, 30,000 workers, you know, walked out. They didn't expect to get a ton of public support. They were shocked by the amount of public support and how people, you know, happily went to shop at competing supermarkets. And I think there's a time where a lot of Americans feel that wages have been far too stagnant, that income inequality is far too great. I write about this at length in my book. And I think that's one reason now when workers go on strike, they feel they're going to have a surprising amount, a strong amount of public support.
Professor Fine, a lot of what we're going to discuss, or the mainstream of our discussion right now, is workers' rights. But I feel like that term needs a little picking apart in terms of what the rights of workers are and what we even mean by a worker, by an employee. A lot of what we're going to discuss, I think, Professor, has to do in part with the meaning of those words today.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great question, Joshua, and a good place to start, because the truth is capitalism just keeps morphing and changing. Firms are endlessly creative about how they approach their business models. But in some ways, we've got a mismatch where labor law and the classification of workers is kind of sitting in the 1930s. And so we have a situation where, there's claims made by some companies like Uber and Lyft, oh, our workers are not employees, other companies that are trying to stick to the old models. But basically, our laws, my students are always shocked to hear, for example, about at-will employment, that they have no rights when they're fired, that there are some things that they can appeal, but that in most cases, without a union contract, they don't have a lot of recourse. And even employee handbooks, a lot of workers don't even know what's in them. They have to try to figure out, they have to try to figure out what their actual coverages and rights are. So I do think that we're in a moment where there's a struggle over the very definition of what a worker is. What it used to mean was you were a full-time employee, you filled out a W-2, you were offered full-time pay and benefits. You were subject to a 40-hour work week or overtime pay. You had some notice about what your schedule was going to be, some protections around health and safety and minimum wage, et cetera. And now all of that is up for grabs as more and more companies have tried to classify their employees as independent contractors. And if an employee is classified as an independent contractor, it means companies no longer have to provide Social Security. It means that they don't have to provide sick time or break time or minimum wages or any of the kinds of things that full-time employees receive. And so, there's a lot of talk today about workers want flexibility, but what polls show is that most workers who are in a situation where they've been forced into part-time work or contingent work or classified as independent contractors would prefer to have it the other way. They'd prefer to be full-time employees. And I'll just add to what my colleague Steve Greenhouse has said. Mm-hmm. You're right that the public's approval of labor unions now Gallup has found it's at 62%. This is a 15-year high. And what I think is really interesting, I have students, PhD students, who study this, and one of them found that, this is an issue, along with support for the minimum wage, that crosses partisan lines.
Right.
So you have Republicans, particularly Republican high school grads, non-high school grads, and low-wage workers who are strongly in favor of unions and minimum wage.
Steve?
So I think with this GM strike, it's important to step back because GM has long been, the iconic American company. And I picked up today's New York Times, and lo and behold, lead story in the paper is this strike by nearly 50,000 GM workers. And there have been previous GM strikes that have really helped set the course of American history. And I think this strike is important because it's kind of calls the question on offshoring, on outsourcing, can a union really effectively limit it? In my book, I write about some other iconic GM strikes, the famous Flint sit-down strike in 1936-37, which was the most important strike in the 20th century. And after GM, for years, had crushed efforts to unionize GM, the strike by 2,000 workers in Flint, Michigan, in the middle of the winter, finally got GM to recognize a union. And that began the humongous wave of unionization during the 1930s. And then there was another huge GM strike right after World War II, 170,000 people, not the 49,000 now. And that lasted nearly 4 months. And that resulted in these huge contracts that famously helped create the world's largest middle class. giving very good raises and health benefits and pension benefits. And that set a pattern for hundreds of other companies to follow. And people really call that the most important labor contract in the 20th century.
Lots of comments from several of you, particularly in support of organized labor. Joseph tweeted, "Organized labor has been attacked for generations. It's about time labor realizes that they're the cogs that make the machines work. Nothing gets done without labor." Professor Fine, I wonder what your sense is of where protections for gig workers stand, people like Lyft and people who drive for services like Uber Eats and Caviar and others. Their labor, they're a large part of the labor pool, but not really organized yet, right?
Well, I think what Steve is raising is really important, right? That UAW is kind of clawing the question in some ways. And the question is whether the UAW can once again, get us to a different place. Particularly, you know, they're also saying that they want to try to increase the number of temps who are offered full-time employment, who are actually able to transition to employee status. And so, in part, you know, that's what this fight is about. And that's not so different, you know, from what's just happened in California. It's not so different from efforts by these drivers in New York City, in Seattle, in San Francisco, Los Angeles, you know, to say, you know, we'd like flexible schedules, but that doesn't mean we can't be full-time employees.
Right.
You know, that doesn't mean. So, yeah, I think that this is a moment.
We'll continue in just a moment with former New York Times labor reporter Steve Greenhouse and Rutgers University Associate Professor Janice Fine. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Almost 50,000 GM workers nationwide walked off the job this morning. They're pushing for higher wages and for the company to reopen plants. To understand how to stage a successful strike, they might look to California. Organizers there have pushed that state ahead of much of the country when it comes to progressive workplace protections, but some critics call California the worst state to do business in. We're speaking with former New York Times labor reporter Steve Greenhouse. His new book is called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And Rutgers Associate Professor Janice Fine, the Director of Strategy and Research at the University's Center on Innovation and Worker Organization. Before we bring in another voice in the conversation, and we welcome more of your comments as well, glad to hear from some of you who are members of affiliated unions of the UAW, the United Auto Workers, which is the union that covers these GM workers. Phil in Michigan emailed, "I'm a very proud UAW member. I support my union 100% on this issue. The UAW came to the rescue of GM 10 years ago. They took massive cuts in pay, healthcare benefits, and pensions. They agreed to a two-tier pay scale with temporary workers. That is a huge issue. Incomes have fallen, workers' rights have been cut. We need more unions to stand up to greedy management and get back some of the things we gave up." We'll get to more of your comments as well. Feel free to comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Steve, the California legislature recently passed a bill known as AB 5, Assembly Bill 5. If it's signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom, it would solidify that gig workers are employees rather than contractors. Gig workers meaning people who drive for Lyft and Uber, who deliver for services, who do tasks for TaskRabbit, that kind of thing. Tell us more about that bill and how big a change that would be if it passed, if it was signed into law.
So, Josh, I'm going to begin this answer with Donald Trump, where so much begins nowadays. You know, as I explained in my book, Donald Trump ran as the best friend of American workers. But as president, he and his administration have taken dozens of anti-worker actions. And I argue that in many ways, his is the most anti-worker, anti-union administration since Ronald Reagan, and perhaps worse. And they've in ways gone out of their way to make it harder for workers. And one thing that Trump's National Labor Relations Board did was say that Uber and Lyft drivers should not be considered employees. They should be considered independent contractors. And only employees have a right to unionize, not independent contractors. Meanwhile, in California, the state Supreme Court issued a decision disagreeing with the Trump administration, saying, no, Uber and Lyft drivers should be considered employees. They're really not entrepreneurs having their own business. What they do is very much in the normal course of business as Uber and Lyft. They're not like plumbers who come in for a day to fix a sink in a large corporation. They're part and parcel of the business.
Well, I think they also argued that without these drivers, Lyft couldn't run. They're integral to the functioning of the business.
Absolutely, absolutely. So unions and a lot of Uber and Lyft drivers pressured the legislature to enact a law that would formally put this Supreme Court decision into law. And if they could, were employees, they can be covered by minimum wage and overtime laws. They could get workers' comp benefits. They can get unemployment insurance as independent contractors. They can't. Now, Uber and Lyft said, we don't want this law at all. We insist these people are independent contractors. And they say the main reason they're independent contractors is that they could choose their own hours. But they really don't have much freedom as workers, in my sense. And the companies warn that if they become employees, then they're not going to be able to determine their hours, that it's going to cost us a lot more to pay them, and we're going to have to hire fewer people, and that's going to hurt consumers. There'll be less convenience. But the state legislature overwhelmingly passed this new law, and California really has become the leading state in enacting pro-worker legislation. It's really kind of in ways been a resistance, a California resistance to to Trump and Republicans who are just sitting on their hands and doing very little to help workers, such as doing nothing for over a decade to raise the minimum wage.
We've heard from a number of you who are independent contractors or Lyft drivers. Your perspectives on this kind of vary. Rodney tweeted, I am an Uber and Lyft driver for 3 years. I love being an independent contractor. I make my own hours, drive where and when I want. I make $100K and never want to be an employee again. At 60 years old, I will remain an independent contractor. We also heard from several of you who work in the gig economy, but not in California. Here's a quick mashup of some of what you left in our inbox.
I'm Nick, living in Orlando, Florida. I've been an independent contractor for the last 2 or 3 years. I do see the benefit of a law like the one in California. I'd love it if I could get health insurance or some time off or some of the benefits that come with working full-time, but still enjoy the flexibility of being able to work on my own schedule for the clients I want to work for.
I am an independent contractor in Virginia. Most of us barely are making a living. Independent contracting is fantastic for the person who's making money off of the contractors, but not so great for us independent contractors pitted against each other out here in the field.
My name is JV. I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a full-time Lyft driver. I've been driving for the past 25 months, and I don't think a large American company should be able to profit off of American workers without us, the drivers, and the company paying into Social Security. As the freest country on earth, we should be putting something away for ourselves later.
Thank you all very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Professor Fine, very briefly, we have one more voice that we want to add in, but this distinction between being an employee and setting your hours, can you just clarify that for us? Is having your hours set by your employer a necessary criterion of being considered an employee, or is it a little more nuanced than that?
I think that's a really good question, Joshua. You would think that in the 21st century, with so many women going to work and so many changes that have taken place, that there'd be a way that workers could be involved in setting their schedule and negotiating with their employer about their schedule without assuming that that's only something that independent contractors can do. You know, lots of workers in the United States are in a situation, middle-class workers, white-collar workers, where they can have a give-and-take with their employer over what their hours will be. It's a failure of imagination to think that the gig economy cannot also that employers in the gig economy rather cannot also do that with their employees, right? So the assumption that somehow if you're an independent contractor you get flexibility, if you're an employee you cannot get flexibility, flies in the face of, you know, actually what these social media companies like Google and are doing with their other sectors of their workforces. You know, you can bet their engineers are getting lots of flexibility, but they're not forcing them into independent contracting status. This is about an asymmetry of power, right? It's about the fact that for years and years, companies have had the field all to themselves. You know, they've been able to oppose unionization. They've been able to oppose changes in federal law, labor law, as well as minimum wage and overtime basic laws. So, you know, we're in a backward moment. You know, we haven't raised the minimum wage since 2009. And there are so many other examples. And I'll just say that a California study found that 8,000 California businesses had nearly 500,000 employees that they had misclassified and left off payrolls. And that's costing California billions of dollars. And it also makes it harder for businesses that are, you know, properly classifying their employees to compete.
Let's add a voice to the conversation, someone who is in California and is at the heart of this whole debate. Joining us from Marketplace in Los Angeles is Roxana Tynan. She's executive director of the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, or LANE. Roxana, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a bit about LANE. It's not a traditional union. It calls itself an advocacy organization. Talk about the work that LANE does.
That's right. We are an alliance of both unions, community groups, environmental and environmental justice organizations. We really think we all stand together in this. Working people also live in communities where they care about things like affordable housing and breathing clean air. And so we really look to make connections across different sectors of our community to be able to help push for the kind of legislation like Assembly Bill 5, that's really going to protect working people. We think we get a lot more done when we're doing it together.
What are some of the other progressive worker protections, Roxana, that you've seen become law in California or become closer to becoming law?
Well, I think one of the most important is the fight for 15, the successful fight that started in a lot of California cities like Los Angeles to get the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And now the entire state of California, the fifth largest economy in the world, is on a pathway to $15 an hour as our minimum wage. And that's a really big deal. It's good for workers. It's good for the state's economy as well.
And I believe Emeryville, California, has pushed its minimum wage, or is pushing, up to $16 and some change an hour. Is that right, Roxana?
That's right. We've also been able to pass paid sick days legislation. It always used to make me laugh that when President Obama was in office, he didn't initially believe when his advisors told him that the United States has no legislation around requiring paid sick days for workers, like virtually every other industrialized country in the world. Here in California, the same assembly member, Lorena Gonzalez, who helped lead Assembly Bill 5, also helped us pass paid sick days in the state. And we've been able to pass even more extensive legislation like that here in Los Angeles and in other cities.
Roxana, what do you think it is about California that allows it to be such fertile ground for these more progressive laws? I mean, I know that, you know, people think of California as just this kind of totally lefty liberal state. There is a supermajority of Democrats in the state legislature and has been for some years. But California is also home to a lot of really big industries like tech, motion pictures, mm-hmm. aerospace, biotech, that are very, very conscious about the money that they spend. I mean, you know, Lyft and Uber are in San Francisco and Oakland, which are not exactly conservative bastions, but they're not crazy about these proposals either.
That's right. I would say our state has not always been as progressive, right? In the 90s, our state legislature was dominated by Republicans. Our governor and other statewide elected officers were all conservative. And we passed a series of pretty anti-worker legislation, in fact, kind of pretty conservative to right-wing legislation over the course of 15 years. It took a lot of organizing, and it really took a labor movement that early on embraced immigrants, embraced immigrant workers, and embraced really building alliances with a broad range of progressive forces so that, frankly, we could punch above our weight. So this state has moved in a steadily progressive direction, I believe in large part because we had a progressive labor movement that really understood that we all had to connect, work together in order to move an agenda that works better for working people.
Also glad to hear from some of you who do different kinds of gig work that we may not think of as such. Jeff tweeted, "Truck driver pay by the mile has been the gig economy since 1935. I'm supposed to be home every day. My load will be done late. so I will have to sleep in my truck. Plus, I work for free several hours into my next shift. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Professor Fine, this argument that California is the worst state for business, or one of the worst states for business. I remember Texas was making that argument some years ago to try to siphon companies away from California, and it did have some success. But what do you make of that argument in terms of it being a bad state to do business?
Well, I think you have to look at the facts. You know, California is booming, and Los Angeles is booming. San Francisco is booming. And, of course, Silicon Valley is booming. So the there are many, many reasons why businesses locate in California. And the idea that somehow, you know, this is the worst state to do business in, I mean, it's just not borne out by the statistics, right? And by the fact that there's so much demand for being in California, because firms want to be in relationship with each other, right? There's, you know, the Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley. L.A. is the epicenter of entertainment. And so much more, you know, that's not going to, you know, I mean, there are so many examples. San Francisco is a city that has been, you know, a place, that people wanted to live for a long time. So to me, there is no, it's not a coincidence that California is leading the way with these laws. I think they're leading the way with these laws because it's a growth state and it's got these growth cities. That, you know, the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy knew that it could use that growth to negotiate to raise working conditions and quality of life for workers in Los Angeles and across the state.
However, on the flip side, Stephen, you know, I was in San Francisco before I came to D.C., and I would have to make a significant salary to go back. I mean, workers may have significant protections, but San Francisco is not an easy place to be a worker right now. I mean, California may be good for businesses, but it seems like, in a way, it's even worse now for employees than it was 10 years ago.
Well, you're exactly right, Joshua. So California is a very expensive place to live, especially San Francisco, the Bay Area, Los Angeles getting expensive. So the state sees that many workers are struggling to make ends meet because the economy is booming so much and so many people are moving there. So it raises the minimum wage to $15. And business says, oh, this is terrible. This is hurting California's business climate. And California lawmakers and unions and worker advocates are saying, we're just trying to help make sure that the people who live and work in California are earning enough to live there. It's not that we're being anti-business. We're just trying to make sure people can afford to live there and go shopping and go to restaurants. And what's happening in California is kind of a backlash against this trend that's been going on in the past few years, where companies are really trying to squeeze workers by using more temps and more independent contractors and contracting out. And that helps push down wages and make jobs much more precarious, much more unstable, much more volatile. And so Assembly Bill 5 is one step to try to bring more stability to the workforce.
And on the flip side of that, Joseph tweeted, there's a clear correlation between the decline of union membership and the stagnation of wages and loss of benefits. Roxanne, I wonder how you reflect on that. And in the interest of full disclosure, I did work at a union organized shop when I was in San Francisco. I was on KQED, which is covered by SAG-AFTRA. But I see kind of both sides of it, Roxanne.
Well, look, I think that for the last 40 years, we've seen a sustained right-wing attack on unions, and whether it's right-to-work laws, i.e. right to work for less, or whether it's permanent replacements for strikers, undermining the power of workers to really withhold their labor and fight for what's fair. So we've seen this sustained attack, and it's taking and it the whole framework of labor law in our country does not help workers organize. It generally sets up a lot of obstacles to organizing. We've been able to push past some of those in California, both through kind of deep and sustained commitment and also being able to change the rules of the game. But that's what it's really going to take for workers to see more in their paychecks.
Much more to discuss as we continue with Roxana Tynan of Lane, Janice Fine of Rutgers, and author Stephen Greenhouse. Mr. Anderson tweeted, all these drivers willingly signed up as contractors. They want all the benefits of being a contractor and all the benefits of being an employee without the downside of either. Sounds like we have a personal responsibility issue here. Interesting point. How much of this is on lawmakers and how much of it is on workers? Stay close. Back now to our conversation with author Steve Greenhouse, Rutgers Associate Professor Janice Fine, and Roxana Tynan, Executive Director of LANE, the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. Glad to have heard from so many of you about the working conditions that you have and the nature of the work that you do. Here's another message. Here's what Jen left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Jen, and I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and I work as a yoga and fitness instructor. So like many teachers, I work for multiple studios, and some of them hire me as an hourly employee and some of them as an independent contractor. I do believe this industry, the fitness and yoga industry, are ready for unionizing to ensure a better living wage for instructors and better benefits going forward.
Jen, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Professor Fine, when unionization efforts succeed, what is it that tends to go right with unionization?
Well, I think that what's interesting about what Jen has just raised, Joshua, if I may, is that what she's raising is, again, you know, we need to be able to update labor laws so that people like Jen, who are yoga instructors and work for multiple employers, still have access to benefits, you know, where her multiple employers can contribute to a portable benefits fund, right? Like that. And we know how to do this. There's a whole history of craft unionism and where people, their permanent relationship is not necessarily with one employer, it's with their union. And so as they move from job to job, the different employers they have are contributing to a benefits fund, you know, are contributing to a pension fund. So I can imagine that unions could solve some of these problems that we see in the 21st century labor market. And I'll just give you an example. You know, there are all these domestic workers around the country and home care workers who are exactly in this kind of situation. The National Domestic Workers Alliance recently created a portable benefits program called ALEA. And it provides an opportunity for employers of domestic workers to contribute to a portable benefits fund. And it's very modest, you know, what the contribution is. But for a domestic worker, if each of her clients contributes to that fund, then she can have benefits, you know. And so I think that, you know, in some ways what unions have done, when you ask what goes right, is that in a lot of ways they can solve some of the coordination problems that exist between employers and particularly small employers. In this, you know, in this situation. And, you know, the other thing I think that unions can do is stand for the whole. You know, Roxanne is in Los Angeles, where I think, you know, there was a kind of an epic teacher strike. And there, you know, the teachers didn't only negotiate on narrow things like work and wages. They negotiated for more nurses and counselors and librarians in the schools.
Yeah.
They negotiated for smaller class sizes. They negotiated for support for immigrant workers in the schools and immigrant children in the schools. And there are so many examples of this bargaining for the common good that are breaking out all over the country.
If I might just jump in.
Yeah.
So in my book, I write about various studies about the advantages of unions. And these studies show that union members earn on average 14% more than comparable non-union workers. 75% of unionized workers participate in their employer-sponsored health plan, compared with just 49% of non-union workers. 83% of union members have an employer-sponsored pension retirement plan, compared to just 49% of non-union workers. We all hear about the pay gap for women. Unionized women make 94 cents on the dollar compared to unionized men, whereas non-union women earned 78 cents on the dollar and compared to non-union men.
And 94 cents per dollar is still 6 cents short.
Yeah,
but
it's still much better than the other. And African-American union members earn on average 17% more than comparable non-union black workers.
But speak to employers, Steve, because, you know, as an employer, even as an employer who's sympathetic to all of these things, in the back of their mind, either they or their treasurer or their CFO is thinking, and it all costs me more. You are counting on me to do better business, to make more money, to cut other costs, to earn more revenue, to make more profit, to continually satisfy my shareholders equally, to pay for all of these things, even if it's a few pennies on the dollar. Pennies make dollars and dollars add up.
No, so you're right, Joshua. So generally, when companies have unionized workforces, they have to pay more in, you know, towards wages, towards benefits. But generally, unionized workers are happier than non-union workers. Generally, there's much less turnover. People stay longer. Generally, when a place is unionized, the workers are better trained because the employer realizes that, hey, these workers like it here. We're going to invest in them. They're going to become more productive. That's much more the case than in many non-union companies. So generally, there's a more stable, happier workforce when you're unionized, but your profits might be cut a little bit.
Wally tweeted, 15 years as a member of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, fourth generation in this union, along with another two generations behind that of coal miners. I stand in solidarity with my fellow union brothers and sisters of the UAW. Worth noting, by the way, that both IBEW and UAW are affiliate unions under the AFL-CIO. Mr. Anderson tweeted, and Roxanne, I'd love you to respond to this one. Mr. Anderson tweeted, all these drivers willingly signed up as contractors. They want all the benefits of being a contractor and all the benefits of being an employee without the downside of either. Sounds like we have a personal responsibility issue here. Roxanne?
Yeah, that just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, the idea that the way the economy works is not so that all of us enter as equal players and get to make choices equally. It's the game is rigged, and it's rigged in the favor of the largest corporate entities in this country. It's rigged in favor of the wealthy. So that to say to a low-wage worker, hey, dude, you got a choice to take any job you like, is simply not true. People choose what's available to them in order to make a living. And they choose in a context where our system of laws protecting workers is nowhere near as good as it needs to be. So those same workers, many of them have been organizing, certainly in California and in other places like New York, for a long time to ensure that they get the same protections as regular employees. And those are the protections that they deserve.
Stephen?
I'm just jumping in. So what this person says is just, you know, factually inaccurate. Uber and Lyft drivers do not have the benefits that many employees have. If you're an employee, your employer has to contribute 6.2% of your pay towards Social Security, has to contribute another percent and a half towards your Medicare, has to give you overtime and minimum wage coverage. And when you're an employee, you're protected by laws, anti-discrimination laws, so you can go to court if you're sexually harassed, if you're fired because of your race or your sex or your age. So, you know, it's just false to say these drivers have the advantages that all employees have.
Hey, by the way, speaking of the one second, was that Professor Fine? Is that
you? Yeah, it was.
Okay, give me 1 second. But before let the professor jump in, by the way, for those of you who are Lyft and Uber drivers and you've never read the fine print, you probably should. If you are a Lyft driver, the link is Lyft.com/terms. To see what the terms of service for Lyft are. And hey, if you're a Lyft user, you may also want to know the terms under which your driver is having to work. Lyft.com, Lyft.com/terms. If you're an Uber driver, it's Uber.com/legal. Uber.com/legal to read the fine print for yourself. Professor?
Well, I was just going to say that I think the terms are constantly changing. And one of the things that I think is difficult is workers are encountering a situation where it's not always easy to tell who the boss actually is when they're a driver for Uber or Lyft or DoorDash or whatever. I had some students in my class who worked for TaskRabbit, and they were very proud of their record as service providers. They loved what they did. They took great joy and satisfaction in it, and they were very highly rated, and they worked really hard for those high ratings that they got, which led to more clientele. When IKEA bought TaskRabbit, they completely changed the algorithm. And what they did was they started to put up not the workers who are most highly rated by the people that they had gone and done tasks for. No, they started to put up the workers who are being paid the least, right, the lowest amount. And so the people who were kind of the elite taskers, because of their reputations and because of the many, many thousands of tasks they had completed successfully, were now at the bottom of the algorithm instead of the top. And so when I talk to Uber drivers and Lyft drivers, TaskRabbiters and others, what I hear over and over again is that they feel that the ground is constantly shifting from beneath them, and that the ways in which pay is raised and lowered, the way that they're incentivized to keep driving driving, even when it's unsafe for them to keep driving for the hours that they are. There's a lot of frustration. So this idea that somehow they're not accepting personal responsibility, right? It's a market where you put your labor out there and then you get hired. And why should these workers have to choose, right, between basic benefits and wages that they can raise a family, that they can support a family on, and flexibility? That's really, a false Hobson's choice, right? There's no reason that they should have to make a choice like that.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Roxana, we should note that California's organizing successes also have kind of extended to college athletes as well. Here's a clip from a commercial that was produced by the College Athlete Advocacy Initiative.
Excited to announce
that for the next 4 years, I'm happy to surrender my name, image, and likeness.
Why they make billions off of ticket sales, TV ratings, and merchandise?
That, of course, goes back to the debate over whether NCAA athletes should be compensated in any way, including for their name, their image, their likeness that are used in commercials or endorsements or video games. And last week, the California legislature passed a bill that would let players profit off their names and likenesses, which is something the NCAA bans and is completely solidly against. That bill is headed to Governor Newsom's desk. Roxana, where does Lane stand on this issue?
Strongly hope that the governor signs it. You know, we shouldn't have one set of rules for companies to profit, but then when it comes to individuals, they lose out. I feel like those kids should be profiting from their own work, their own value. So I think we want an economy that has one set of rules that really function for everybody. And that's not what we have now. So I think the legislature is looking for opportunities to try and ensure there is a more even and fair playing field for everybody who, is effectively entering the workforce in one way or another.
Arthur emailed, "The argument that the Trump administration has been the most hostile to workers in decades is rich, considering that wage increases have been significantly higher under it than under the previous administration." Steve, what would you say to Arthur?
I don't think that's true. Yes, wages are finally going up somewhat under President Trump. And people forget that they're also going up towards in the second term of President Obama. And again, people forget that under Obama, the unemployment rate fell from a peak of 10% down to 4.7%, a drop of 4.3%. Under President Trump, the unemployment rate has dropped from 4.7% by, one full percentage point to 3.7%. So President Trump took office when the economy was in pretty good shape. And it was like, he became president when on third base and thought that he had hit a triple.
I should note, by the way, that there was an Associated Press fact check of that claim, and it notes that the president is claiming credit for a trend of rising wages for some workers that does predate his presidency, and that the gains in pay are not necessarily flowing to blue-collar workers. Michael emailed, and Roxana, maybe you can respond to this as well, with regard to organizing tactics. Michael emailed, "When my stepfather, near the end of his career, opposed the organization of nurses at his hospital, his gas tank got sanded. Ugly. When some of the wiremen and electricians up here in New Hampshire went on strike, someone broke into a high-voltage transmission site and cut a wire that shut down power for about 10,000 people. It's hard to feel for unions with things like this." Roxana, I know that every union does things slightly differently, and of course, no one is advocating breaking the law. But how do you see the perception of unions these days?
I think, as was mentioned earlier, it's very positive because unions are, one of the most clear ways for folks to really change their lives, to really build lives that can support families and can support people's dreams. I think those examples are extremely rare. Unfortunately, what is not rare is employers breaking the law in the face of organizing efforts. In almost every organizing effort in this country, employers bend or break the rules around respecting workers' rights to organize. That is endemic, and that's something we really need to do something about so that folks, can effectively band together to get better wages, to get better benefits, to really improve the quality of their lives.
Ken emailed, as a worker for AT&T and part of CWA, the Communication Workers of America, we went on strike to fight the squeeze you mentioned from the corporate leaders. Although we were out only 4 days, we are still fighting with them to reach a fair contract. CEOs and stockholders of this company just don't get it. Professor Fine, before we split, we've spent this hour talking about California. Where else do you see states that are making movements in terms of workplace protections, either more advantageous to workers or more advantageous to or requested for businesses, before we go?
Well, you know, you'd be surprised to know that many Republican states actually have raised the minimum wage. So again, this is a an issue that crosses partisan lines. So in addition to New York and California and Washington State and Illinois and Pennsylvania, we have states that, you know, we would not expect, like Arkansas, that have raised the minimum wage and others. And so actually, I think that this is a moment when we're going to see more and more shifts across partisan lines where, you know, minimum wage and support for unions and recognition that that there has to be a shift, you know, is going to grow and grow some more. Florida, another state where there's been, you know, successful raising of the minimum wage. A lot of purple states. Texas, you know, there's been major union organizing that's taken place in Texas in the last few years. So I think that we're in for a shift. Mm-hmm. You know, that this is a moment that people will look back on, I think. You know, and I think the presidential candidates, the fact that they feel that they have to come out with these how they would support unions to grow and organize is a real indication, right, that something different is afoot.
Janice Fine, an associate professor at Rutgers. Professor Fine, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Greenhouse, his new book is called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Steve, thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Roxana Tynan, the executive director of the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. Thanks, Roxana.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about her and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.